The world is a very different place from the one the first humans inhabited. Our foot and fingerprints are all over this planet, and there is constant debate over just how far we should go to put nature back in a natural state where possible, quotes around natural. Do we even know what that means? That is among the questions raised in a book by our next guest. Jordan Fisher-Smith is the author of Engineering Eden, a true story of a violent death, a trial, and the fight over controlling nature. Jordan Fisher-Smith is photographed on his book Dust Jacket wearing a shirt with the U.S. Forest Service Herald. He spent 21 years as a park ranger in several western states. His shorter writing has appeared in the L.A. Times magazine and other publications. He's also the author of a book, Nature Noir, and the narrator of a documentary called Under Our Skin. He'll be appearing tomorrow at 2 at the Ashland Library. He's here on The Exchange with us now. Jordan Fisher-Smith, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me on.
Good to have you. Can we guess that you got a feel for the nature versus people tension in your 2 decades plus as a ranger?
You bet. I sort of spent all that time at the edge, at the contact zone between people and nature. And, you know, the subject fascinates me. I guess I started out to be a nature writer, but I'm really sort of always drawn to stories about people.
Well, you got to love one of the quotes at the front of the book. Ecosystems are not only more complex than we think, but more complex than we can think. That's from Frank Egler. He must have a fair amount of company, though.
Yeah, I think that, you know, certainly a lot of our political discourse in this country anyway is pretty simplistic. And, and when it comes to issues affecting the global or local environment, simple isn't necessarily good. So I think maybe this book is a call for people to see the interrelatedness of everything around them, people, events, places.
When you think, Jordan, about the simplistic nature of the debates over the environment, do you place the simplicity on both sides?
How do you mean that? You mean both political sides of the aisle in Congress?
Yes.
You know, I don't know that you know that book tour that I'm on right now is about blaming anybody. I think you know, it's more useful for us to say what we want than what we don't want. And I guess I'm just saying that that you know, in our political discourse, we've been reduced to little short, punchy sentences that often are designed to elicit anger in people. You know, I think in making a livable future, anger is probably not the most useful emotion that we have.
This book is rather like an anti-bumper sticker, I guess, in that sense. You get a chance to really delve into some of the issues here.
Yeah, I mean, it was a wonderful adventure to research this book. You know, I spent years in wilderness areas and national parks and archives building this story.
So let's begin to unpack the story. Who was Harry Walker?
You know, Harry Walker was just a hardworking family guy. He died at 25. He grew up in the Chuckalaca Valley outside of Anniston, Alabama. He was part of a tight-knit family. And, you know, in a way, he just sort of appeared in the wrong place at the wrong time. And the book is an examination of the tendrils of interconnectedness coming out of a single death and the trial, the high-profile federal trial that followed.
So the trial was his family suing the federal government for allowing him to be killed by a grizzly bear in Yellowstone. Is that the essence of it?
Yeah, you know, the family sued, charging that the federal government had mismanaged nature, essentially. And that's where the book takes off, that essentially the family, grief-stricken family, had lost their right hand. You know, Harry was the future of their farm. They ran a dairy farm. And they were contacted by an environmental and animal rights activist who convinced them to file suit against the federal government in order to air grievances about the management of nature at Yellowstone National Park, notably the management of grizzly bears.
Why was Harry Walker in Yellowstone in the first place if he was such a family guy and the future of the farm in Alabama?
Harry went through a moment in his life, about the last year of his life, that many of us go through, where, you know, we begin questioning what our lives are about, what we're really here for, what matters to us. And like many young guys, he just took off and took the Great American Road Trip. It's, you know, it is kind of a 4th of July story because he it was pretty close. It was just coming up on the summer solstice. And he had a friend there in Alabama that was kind of a drifter, and his friend said, "Hey, these other friends of mine are leaving town. Do you want to go?" And this began a hitchhiking trip. They passed all through many states. You know, they went east up to Ohio and New York, and then doubled back west again across Nebraska, and then to Colorado, and then north along the Rocky Mountains. And, you know, by all accounts, Harry was having the best time in his whole life. He'd never really, you know, dairy people don't leave much. They have to be there twice a day to milk the cows. And Harry had really never been anywhere. And he was out seeing the country. And it just happened that he turned up at Yellowstone in the middle of the festivities, celebrating 100 years of success in saving nature at Yellowstone. So... And then right in the middle of these festivities, a few hours after the dedication of the new visitor center at Old Faithful, he was dragged away screaming by a grizzly bear and partly eaten.
And not a particularly vibrant grizzly bear at that, but, you know, the fact is that they're still dangerous when they're old and toothless, as this one apparently was getting close to being.
You know, you're right. Apparently you've read this book closely. You know, as grizzly bears move into old age, their nutritional status sometimes suffers, and older bears are considered a little more of a risk sometimes. There is an association between aging. But I think what I really wanted to bring out about this bear was that nature has a memory for what we've been doing in the past, and we have to live sometimes with the effects of our previous actions in nature.
Treatment of bears in Yellowstone, certainly a central theme of the book Engineering Eden. Its author, Jordan Fisher-Smith, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Jordan and take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. On the Jefferson Exchange, on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Jordan Fisher-Smith, a writer with a lot of work under his belt and many years also working as a park ranger in several western states. He's written a book called Engineering Eden, the true story of a violent death, a trial, and the fight over controlling nature. The violent death was Harry Walker's death by grizzly bear in Yellowstone National Park. The trial was his family suing the federal government over bear management in Yellowstone. Engineering Eden asks the question, can we engineer our way back to the Garden of Eden in a sense? It's a big fight in America that goes on every day. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. As you mentioned, Harry Walker happened to show up in Yellowstone about the time the 100th birthday of the park was being celebrated. You say, though, that Yellowstone is an interesting choice for a first place for the federal government to preserve. Why so?
Well, you know, Yellowstone, it just happened not only the first place for our federal government to preserve, but the first national park, the first preserved wilderness in the world. You know, Yellowstone is a very, very historic moment and place. In 1872, just after the Civil War, the Congress creates this preserve, 2 million acres. Unfortunately, but perhaps paradoxically, it's sitting on top of an active volcano that could vaporize the whole place within months or thousands of years. These kind of massive volcanic eruptions aren't on a time schedule that fits in well with our close monitoring of history, but the whole park is underlain by this 2-mile-high mass of lava.
You know, the documenting in here is pretty good, too. You tell us about the fact that there are places where they can show that the land has risen a couple of feet in places, that Yellowstone Lake has tipped. There are trees underwater at one end of it. So, yeah, definitely the live volcano aspect of things quite clear. Apart from Yellowstone, though, broader across the West, Jordan, you compare the loss of pristine lands to the loss of the famous library at Alexandria. Explain that comparison.
Well, you know, nature is composed of, as we know now from all the gene investigations, composed of information. And in this book, I think I say it's composed of memory. Nature has made a record not only of itself, but of everything we've done. And I guess I'm sort of, you know, I've just always been fascinated with these preserved wilderness areas. First of all, they're, you know, ever since I was a child, I found them incredibly beautiful. But the whole activity of trying to save some of this fabric that made us has always just fascinated me. And I write, sort of, I'm obsessed with it. You know, everything I write seems to be about this activity of saving pieces of nature.
Well, but you know, before the saving of nature, there was the use of nature, and you know, it's well documented the fact that the timber industry moved west in search of trees. Over, you got good records here, though, and it was, what was it, in 1850, New York was actually the top timber producing state.
I am so grateful. You know, I have to tell you that I don't get this on every radio station.
People reading the book.
Can I digress really quickly?
Sure.
You know, we were talking a moment ago about connectivity between people and events and places. I hope your listeners know what an amazing connectivity JPR is giving them in Southern Oregon and Northern California. I mean, this is such a resource. And, you know, it's not to be taken for granted. And sometimes when I'm on AM in various places, you know, they don't have time to read the book the way you have. And I just really appreciate JPR and what you're doing for your community there.
Thank you. You're very kind.
Anyway, to answer your question, what was the question?
about the
digression there.
About the records of the timber industry moving west.
Yeah.
For example, 1850, New York is the number one timber producing state.
Right.
Who would have thought?
Right. Well, this is what spawned this whole movement to save nature. People of vision by the 1860s could really see that it was all going to go away real quick if we didn't save some of it. And, you know, I think what I found through my research as a writer is just how modern really the late 19th century was in many respects, that people are looking at nature and they're going, man, we are chewing through this at a fabulous rate, and it's all going to be gone if we don't save some of it. Unfortunately, what wasn't there yet, as I say in the book, was the science of ecology, that this complexity that Frank Egler's talking about in that little epigrammatic quote at the beginning of the book, that, you know, the science of ecology that would be necessary to manage these places didn't appear in history until the same time as nuclear physics, very, very late in history for the good of these places. And in the absence of the science of ecology, these early managers and rangers managed these parks and wilderness areas by the seat of their pants with a technique that a national park scientist friend of mine calls cowboy biology.
So did the creation of Yellowstone as a national park, as a preserve space in 1872, I mean, did they actually say, okay, these areas on the map we're not going to touch anymore? Was it that explicit?
Well, almost. I mean, I think that the emphasis at that time was the sort of spectacles, you know, these great geysers and bubbling mud pots and stuff like that. At the time the park was created, you know, the so-called Yellowstone Organic Act that Congress passed said, you know, we're going to save this place for the benefit of the future generations. But they're really talking about the natural and historic objects, you know, these curiosities. And initially, Yellowstone wasn't really designed or thought of as a wildlife refuge. And as the book says, as time went on, very quickly people involved understood it to be that. Unfortunately, as I say in the book, the squareness of the park didn't exactly reflect the roundness and connectivity of nature.
So let's talk about the wildlife park aspect of it, because it would almost be funny if it weren't for the fact that it got occasionally tragic for both people and for animals. But what were the early interactions between humans and critters like? What were they encouraged to be?
Well, early on when the park was first created, they didn't really have a staff, and this was a time of that we were talking about earlier in timber, but also in everything else. There was a massive uncontrolled exploitation of nature. And at that time, of course, there was a major business of supplying people with flesh and feathers and skins from wild nature. These were things that you didn't have to, to grow on a farm. You could just go out and shoot. So the first thing that happened to Yellowstone was what the Yellowstone historian Paul Schillery calls an ecological holocaust. There were thousands and thousands of elk taken for things as small as the what they called the tusks, the elk teeth that the fraternal order of elks, the lodge, the Elks Lodge, is valued as a sign of the business guy's membership. They have a little pendant made of these elk teeth. And they took the elk hides, which make a very supple leather. There's a scene in the book where somebody sees the new train going down the canyon away from Yellowstone, loaded with dead wildlife. That was the first thing that happened. And then there was an effort made among conservationists to put an end to that with law enforcement. Eventually, they had to call in the army. And at full strength, the Army had something like 350 soldiers guarding that place.
To do what? I mean, who were they guarding from?
The first thing that had to be stopped was just this shooting. I mean, essentially, what was going on there is what we see, what we've seen in the last few decades in Africa, where you have immense poaching that's really going to make things extinct. And it very nearly made the bison extinct. There was a deliberate effort to kill the bison everywhere else, to starve out, this genocidal effort to starve out the Indians. But at Yellowstone, they were trying to save them. And there were so many poachers in there that they almost lost the bison. So the Army first had to protect Yellowstone. And then once this protection happened, the protection itself, as you know from reading the book, began to make an imprint on the land. In other words, the way that we conceive of saving nature has a historic imprint on the land. And the way they conceived it was, we've had a lot of our elk shot, so we shouldn't allow wolves to take so many elk. And they began wiping out wolves and cougars.
Yikes. Engineering Eden is the book by Jordan Fisher Smith, The True Story of a Violent Death, A Trial, and the Fight Over Controlling Nature, the subtitle. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the quest to try to restore nature to something like what it once was, although admittedly our knowledge is somewhat limited. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. You point out in the book, Jordan, that as early as the 20s, ecologists were complaining about the approach of the Park Service, and was it around things like, well, let's kill the wolves to make sure the elk survive?
Yeah, the Ecological Society of America could see that the Park Service was behind the curve. As ecology became codified in these great works, there were people qualified to operate the parks better than they were operated. But fairly early on, the national parks were taken over by operational concerns, meaning that the ranger force was really sort of interested in getting people around and making sure they were entertained with nature stories and interacting with the concessioners, the hotel people, and so on. And they weren't particularly strong as the science of ecology developed. They weren't particularly strong until the moment around the end of the 20s, beginning of the 30s, when this character, George Wright, and some of the other early biologists sort of infiltrated the Park Service and began to set things right.
So was there an early sorting into two camps of just leave alone versus manipulate? In other words, lay fallow versus restore?
Great question. That's at the heart of this book, I think, you know, that the national park, Yellowstone and the other, and there's several other national parks in this book as we follow this story, really is sort of a, you know, symbol of the, I'm using it as a symbol of the greater world. The question is, how are we going to put things to right, and how are we going to make it through the next decades? And in the book, there's this expression of this controversy between, you know, respecting nature's autonomy and mechanicking nature, being a sort of engineer of nature. And these two approaches really ran head on into each other in this trial that the book is about.
The trial, for the folks who might have missed it, we're talking about Harry Walker, a 25-year-old guy from Alabama who had gone on his quest to find America, find himself, ended up dead at the hands of a grizzly bear, as if a grizzly bear had hands, at the claws of a grizzly bear, to be very exact, in Yellowstone National Park. That's the story around which Engineering Eden is written. We have a question here from Boyd in Wolf Creek from email. He says, there's this Y2Y project, the idea of connecting Yellowstone with wildlife bridges all the way to the Yukon. Isn't this the future of viable wild areas? Have you heard about that, Jordan?
Very much so. And thank you for bringing that up. And I know Wolf Creek a little bit. It's a great place. The Yellowstone to Yukon really comes out of some of the characters in this book. You remember that there are these two twin brothers, John and Frank Craighead. And Frank Craighead becomes a witness at this trial where he's opposed. He's on the opposite sides with the son of Aldo Leopold. Some of your listeners may recognize the name of Aldo Leopold.
Yeah, when Starker Leopold shows up in the book, it's like, wait a minute, Leopold?
Yeah. So the trial contains these two great biologists of the 20th century testifying against each other about, you know, how to save nature. But anyway, Frank Craighead was a famous grizzly researcher. He and his brother conducted the first great modern study of grizzly bears at Yellowstone when they were threatened, and the inventor of the radio collar. And as these guys began following grizzlies with radio collars, they were able to document that grizzlies didn't care which side of the boundary they were on. They didn't care about legal definitions of private and public land. They didn't care about the difference between a national forest and a national park. And the Craighead brothers really documented, you know, how it was necessary to conduct management of public lands instead of a balkanized system of, you know, I'm a forest, you're a park, we don't agree on things. They showed that wildlife would have to be able to move around to survive. That idea resulted in what we now call the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem, and eventually this business of connecting, creating corridors for wildlife to move all the way from Yellowstone to the Yukon across the international boundary.
But, you know, it seems like long before the Craigheads did their research and came up with this, that people had to figure out things like not leaving garbage dumps around for bears, which went on for decades, apparently, at Yellowstone.
Yeah, I called, I think I said at some point that Yellowstone became a kindergarten for a society or a civilization that in so many other ways was incredibly sophisticated. You know, this is a civilization that laid a telegraph cable across the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean from Ireland to Nova Scotia by 1866 and 67. We are incredibly sophisticated, but Yellowstone became a kindergarten for our relations with nature, which, you know, really have been, to the present day, have been incredibly backward.
So by the time that Harry Walker visits Yellowstone, I presume the garbage dumps were gone? I mean, how far in that timeline did he fall?
Well, you know, that's sort of the story, and thank you for reading it again. What happened was this: we were talking a few minutes ago about the early attempts to save nature and the primitiveness of some of their attitudes, and they were stuck then with all kinds of things being out of balance. And the book also has stuff in it about elk and fire. You know, we had been preventing fires, and they'd killed off all the wolves and cougars at Yellowstone, so they had an elk overpopulation. Well, came a time in the 1960s when they began thinking, we've got to fix this stuff. But how to fix it is the question at that moment. And there is a you know, that there's an immediate response to the idea that what is unnatural ought to be removed from the national parks. And one of the most unnatural things were these open garbage pits that the bears had been feeding at for some 80 years. And so an attempt was made to rapidly close them. And as the book shows, there was hell to pay. Bears came charging into campgrounds. There were many conflicts and dangerous incidents between bears and people. And, you know, dozens of bears in 1 year, 57 of grizzlies were killed by in various ways in these kind of conflicts. So I think what the book says is, back to Frank Egler's epigrammatic quote at the beginning of the book, you know, that nature is complicated, and we have to be very careful about simple solutions.
Was there case law already then, by the time that that Harry Walker's family sued the federal government over his death at by grizzly bear?
You know, that's another great question. The case law that shows up in this trial, and I read multiple times through 1,745 pages of trial transcripts to create this book, which I had found in the archives at Yellowstone National Park, sort of by accident, really. And, you know, the case law was all about the responsibility of the government for getting people killed. What it wasn't about was there wasn't much in that trial yet about, you know, nature. The nature argument was broader and more interesting because it wasn't bounded at that moment by case law.
All right, we have a couple more minutes left with Jordan Fisher-Smith on the other side of a break. His book is Engineering Eden. We'll come back and talk more with him and take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're going to switch topics in a couple minutes. We have a couple minutes left with Jordan Fisher-Smith, former park ranger and now writer of a lot of information about the environment. Engineering Eden is his latest book, The True Story of a Violent Death, a Trial, and the Fight Over Controlling Nature. And the violent death was Harry Walker, a fellow from Alabama, killed by a grizzly bear in Yellowstone National Park. His family put the federal government on trial for it. So let's talk about the trial specifically, because by some legal jujitsu, the case ended up heard in court, in federal court in L.A. Why there?
Yeah, well, the you know, these farmers, the family of Harry Walker, were sort of seduced or romanced by an animal rights and environmental activist who was trying to save the grizzly bears into suing the government to make everything right. And they were in danger, really, of losing their farm. Harry was an essential part of the workforce that contained really just his father and himself. And so in so doing, this woman from Missouri connected them with a very, very good attorney in Los Angeles, who literally levitated the case out of its natural venues in Wyoming or Alabama, where Harry was from, and transplanted it into the middle of downtown Los Angeles on Spring Street at the federal courthouse, where they then flew in all the witnesses from the Rockies. It was an epic trial, and one that I'll describe a little more. I'm going to be in Ashland tonight. Did we mention that?
I forgot to mention that. I have an appearance tomorrow at 2 at the library. Is there another one?
I'm sorry, not tonight. You're right. I'm city of my end. This is the condition of the book tour.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, thanks to the wonderful Ashland librarian, Amy Blossom, I'll be at the Ashland Public Library at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. In the Gresham Room.
I have you at 2 o'clock. I don't mean to argue with you about your own schedule, but 2 o'clock is what it shows on. Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. 3 o'clock. I looked at it wrong. Ta-da!
You had me going there because I'd already made a mistake about tonight. So.
Sorry. Yeah.
As far as I know, it's 3 o'clock.
Second of July at 3 o'clock. Yes.
Yeah, and it's in the Gresham Room at the Ashland Public Library. That beautiful facility that was added to a few years ago. And thanks to Bloomsbury Books, the great Ashland bookstore, the book will be available there. And I think also my last book, Nature Noir, will be there. And there's an Ashland company that actually produced the audiobook for the new book. your own Blackstone Books. I think they'll have some audiobooks there.
All right, sounds great. So did the trial, there was eventually money for the Walker family, for Harry's family, but did it really resolve anything in terms of deciding a way forward for us to consider how we manage wild places in America?
Well, you know, about the money, the family won, and then they lost in appeals court. The case went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court kicked it back down and let the ruling stand. It then went to the Congress, and this poor Alabama family went through a six-year odyssey in the federal courts and Congress, which essentially ended in them losing their farm business.
Oh, boy.
As far as what happened in the trial, I think part of the purpose of this book is to sort of vindicate the Craigheads. Frank Craighead, who testified, one of the really the star witness for the Walker family, charged the Park Service with mismanaging nature. And, you know, for their trouble, the Craigheads were basically run out of Yellowstone, and their careers were not entirely ruined, but very badly damaged by this collision with the federal government. So both the Walker family and these great biologists were in a collision with the full might of the federal government. So part of this purpose of this book is to set that to right. And what was learned really out of this was the connectivity of everything, you know? I mean, Herman Melville says someplace, 1,000 fibers connect us with our fellow men. And among those fibers, as sympathetic threads, our actions run as causes, and they come back to us as effects.
We have an email here from Eleanor. She says, I have a grimly fascinating book called Death in Yellowstone, collection of accounts of every kind of human death there, from bears to boiling springs. I'm sure Jordan knows about it. A quick look in the index took me to the Harry Walker incident, and here's the first paragraph. An entire book could be written on the Harry Walker case alone, to which Eleanor says, congrats, Jordan.
You know, that's I know that quote, and I know that's Lee Whittlesey, the historian at Yellowstone, who wrote that book, and these books have become popular in the parks, encyclopedic compendiums of every death in the parks for some reason.
Wow. It's interesting stuff in your book, and it really raises some compelling questions that go far beyond Harry Walker's his own case, but the idea of what we do, whether we should leave nature alone or whether we do have to go back in there and tinker to make sure it gets back to what it was, if we even know what that is. Lots of stuff raised in Engineering Eden. Jordan Fisher-Smith, the author, 3 o'clock tomorrow at the Ashland Library. Jordan, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thanks for having me on the Queen of the Airwaves in Northern California and Southern Oregon.
You're very kind. Thanks a lot.